Blackness is inclusive of queer people, but they have to understand that, right? Like, they think like we're at war with our Blackness, when it's like, no, you are at war with your Blackness, because you don't fully understand that your Blackness has to encompass people that have a different identity than you.
Welcome to Dear Culture, the podcast that gives you news you can trust for the culture. I'm Jaron Keith Gaynor, Managing Editor at The Griot.
And I'm Stephen London, the director of video at The Griot. And this week we are asking, Dear Culture, how far have we come and how much further do we have to go?
Hey, Dear Culture fam. We just want to thank you for joining us and tuning into the show every week. It means a lot to us here at The Griot.
Yes, thank you so much. I know that the last few months have been super tough, to say the least. So we appreciate you taking out some time out of your day to spend with us.
Absolutely. Here at The Griot, it's our mission to report the most pressing issues affecting Black people, to provide context and even expose our readers and listeners to different perspectives, and that's core to our mission. But we think it's important to celebrate our triumphs as well.
I definitely agree. And with that in mind, on this week's episode, we want to acknowledge Pride, because it's Pride Month. At the core, it's really a celebration of triumph as a community and a collective. And we have so much to celebrate. Last week, a landmark Supreme Court decision expanded worker protections under the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to cover gay and trans people. Prior to the court's decision, which was made with a 6-3 majority, it was legal in more than half the country to fire someone for being gay or trans.
Wow, Stephen, we really can't overstate how much of a big deal that decision is. Is the result of decades of pressure and activism moving the LGBT community from the margin to the mainstream. And we have many countless people to thank for where we are right now. It really feels like we've arrived somewhere new, including queer and trans people in the movement for Black lives. Earlier this month, roughly 15,000 people took to the streets in Brooklyn in support of Black trans people, which feels inconceivable even a year or two ago.
And you need to take it, and you need to process it, and you need to keep carrying forward with it every single day of your life. Because we don't get to determine when we're Black and when we're trans.
Queer and trans victims of police violence have also had their stories centered in the Black Lives Matter movement in ways they haven't been before. Tony McDade, a 38-year-old trans man, was shot and killed by police in Florida last month. It's easy to imagine a world where that wouldn't have been a headline, but thanks to the work of demonstrators, McDade's story and the stories of other queer and trans people are finally being included in the fight for justice for all Black people.
Absolutely. I think it's so important that we identify the fact that it's about time, you know, that we're all included in this fight and that, you know, all Black lives do matter. Black queer people have always been a part of the fight for Black liberation, for sure. You know, names like James Baldwin, Audre Lorde, and Angela Davis immediately come to mind. And there are so many others. Of the three women who founded Black Lives Matter, Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tamati, two of whom identify as queer. So this is nothing new. But having queer and trans voices heard in the fight for Black liberation and centered definitely is.
So today, we felt it was appropriate to speak with three people who have been pivotal in moving the discussion of queer and trans Black people forward. Delon Burnside, George M. Johnson, and Laverne Cox. First, we're joined by one of the stars of Pose, Delon Burnside. The show follows the house of Evangelista, one of several houses competing in Harlem's ballroom scene in the 1980s. It's not only received praise for the acting and production, but it also features the largest cast and crew of trans creatives ever. But he's not just joining us to talk about Pose, which was renewed for a third season. He's actually hosting a 6-part series on PBS called Prideland, which explores the life in LGBT communities across the South. So Delon, welcome to The Griot's Dear Culture podcast. It's actually our Pride episode. I want to talk to you about representation and about advocacy. And so before we get started, you know, I really want to go back to Pose, like season one, because when I watched Pose, like we're the same age. And when I watched Pose and I saw Ricky fall in love with Damon, and I see, you know, two young Black queer men falling in love, and I thought to myself, that would have been so transformative for me if I grew up seeing that on TV.
Yeah.
What did it mean to you to be a part of that kind of moment for the culture?
It meant so much. You know, Janet Mock talks about in her book, Redefining Realness, how she didn't get to see images of trans women that were positive in the media. There was always pain and sort of a punchline attached to their existence in the media, and how important it's been for her to sort of reframe and reshape those narratives. And she, as executive producer and writer and director on our show, is not only doing that for the trans community, but for Black and brown men who identify as queer or gay. And it has, in some ways, helped me to reclaim my own narratives, my own personal narratives that people have told me about what it means to be queer. And it's also helped to heal some of those wounds that young Delon needed to heal to be able to stand up and be seen, and to have these stories be told and be shown in the light, instead of it just being in the dark. To be able to tell these stories and bring them to the light has been really healing and impactful for me on a personal level.
And I also love the fact that Ricky represented, I think, a more of a fullness of what it looks like to be Black and queer. Because on season one, again, you were like, you know, sexy and masculine. But then, you know, as the show developed, we saw him embrace his femininity too. Many of us feel we have to choose one extreme over the other.
Yeah.
And there's such a fullness and richness there. And I wonder how that has impacted the way you show up as a gay queer man in the world.
I think, you know, that's a journey that I was on prior to Pose. Just sort of, like you said, embracing the fullness of who I am and who I can be, who I can be in my body. But I think that it's something that I explored in the comfort of my home. It's something that I explore in the context of a relationship with an intimate partner. It's something that I explore with my friends, not necessarily something that I explore in a public way. Because again, like, we're taught that being a man is supposed to mean one thing. I grew up in a family that was very interested in me being a certain kind of man. I grew up in a very like hyper-masculine environment. And you know, we sometimes criticize the men in our families for upholding this thing, but the women uphold it too, and they support it. And so the environment in which I grew up was one that said, this is your man, and you're supposed to be this way, and you're supposed to move like this, and talk like this, and think like this, and be interested in that, and dress like this. And some of those things I identify with. I naturally identify with. And some of those things, not so much. Some of those things are like, well, maybe I would much rather go to a ballet class than throw a football. And that doesn't say actually, which doesn't actually say anything about sexuality or gender, but we've sort of assigned them to gender and we've assigned them to sexuality in a way that it's put us all in these boxes that don't allow us to be full human beings. Forget the queer part, forget the gender part. Like, I'm a human being that should be allowed to express myself in the fullness of who I am, in the fullness of joy that I can.
I want to talk about Pride Land. I actually just watched the first installment. This is brought to viewers by PBS, and it was very touching. It was so well done. I have to admit, I cried like a couple times.
Oh, wow.
I cried a couple times. Tell me first, how did you get started with this project? Is this something that you pitched to PBS?
No, actually, they came to me with it. The production company, Tiny Horse Productions, who was working with PBS on this, they approached me to host it. And I thought, this sounds like an interesting idea. And so we started having conversations about it. And because I'm from the South, I grew up in Georgia and in Pensacola, Florida. And because I'm Southern, I have Southern roots, I had a special connection to it, to the project. And yeah, we just sort of, they approached me about it and I said, yeah, let's do it. I'm game for it.
And for listeners who don't know what Prideland is about, you go to the South and you're talking to everyday people in Mississippi and Texas and in other states. And some of them are part of the LGBTQ community. Some of them are parents. Some of them are elected officials who are standing up for the community. And you mentioned, as you mentioned before, you're from the South, and this was kind of like your return to the South since fleeing the South, because you felt like you could be more your authentic self as a gay man in New York. Could you tell viewers a little bit about that experience of going back to the South and the conversations that you had with some of the people?
Yeah, so I left Pensacola about 8 years ago to move to New York to study theater. I wanted to be on Broadway. And I also felt, I had also just had been forced out of the closet, and which is why I sort of have feelings about the whole idea of coming out. I felt like not only did I need to move to New York for my career, but I needed to get out of the small town to go to a place that would be more accepting and more affirming, and quite frankly, a place where I could be sort of anonymous and like be who I wanted to be because nobody actually cared and was paying attention. And so, I mean, I've come back to visit family and spend time over the years, but this trip was a little bit different because I was coming back to talk about the things that I had avoided talking about in the South for so long. So, I mean, I just wasn't having these hard conversations, and I really didn't know what the thoughts were, how far along people had really come in the South, because I just wasn't having those conversations. And so not only what did this start conversations with the people that I got to meet while filming Prideland, but it also started conversations with amongst my family, and we started talking about these things, and they're like, so what is this thing that you're doing? And some of my family, we actually filmed some things together for Prideland, but that didn't actually get put into the project. But yeah, it was interesting to come back to the South and realize that there's so many folks who are fighting for change. And there's so many folks who are open-minded, and you know, it's not just these pockets in the Northeast and on the West Coast that have thriving LGBTQ communities and allies. That really opened my eyes and has even sort of fortified me as I am navigating the current climate of the world, as we are seeing, as we're fighting for the rights for Black people and for equality and justice and fighting against police brutality and white supremacy. You know, it's easy to sort of say, you know, this country is screwed up and like, I want to get up out of here and move to someplace else. But this is our home. This is our country. We built it. And so it's ours, and we have to stay and fight for it. And Prideland is really, really taught me a lot about that.
Why is it important for you to not just be DeLon Burnside, the star of Pose, and to channel or harness your celebrity and the attention that people now have on you to bring attention to a lot of the issues that still plague the Black community and the Black LGBTQ community?
I mean, it would be so much easier to just be Ricky on Pose, but that's just not who I am. You know, I've always been outspoken. I always got in trouble for speaking out of turn in class and you know, when I was in school, and I've always had an opinion, and not just an opinion for an opinion's sake, but I feel like it's important when you believe in something that you speak out on it. You know, I worked in ministry for a bit, and I think in many ways, the work that I do is still ministry. It's about bringing people together. It's about creating community. It's about sharing more love in the world and acceptance, and hopefully creating work that helps people heal. So, you know, when I think about that sort of mission or purpose, feeling like I've been called to that kind of mission or purpose, I just can't not use my platform to speak to those things. There are days when I think, oh my gosh, this is like exhausting, and I wonder if this is actually gonna hurt my acting career, that I'm like being so vulnerable or transparent about my personal life or talking about, speaking up about things that are political and people don't like their artists to be too political. You know, I sometimes think maybe I should pull back, but I can't not. I can't not speak up. There's just something that that compels me to do so. So,
well, it's making impact for sure.
I hope so. I hope so.
Thank you so much, DeLon Burnside, for joining us on Dear Culture. And please follow us on Instagram and share the love, and we will do the same.
Yes, thank y'all.
We want to thank DeLon so much for joining us. Prideland is available now on pbs.org.
What stood out to me in my interview with DeLon was how working on Pose helped him explore his relationship with his masculinity and femininity. As a queer man myself, I too have had to navigate that duality.
Absolutely. This is something that I think happens a lot in the LGBTQ plus community. That actually seems very connected to our conversation with our next guest, who's an activist, writer, and journalist, and whose new memoir, All Boys Aren't Blue, is meant to serve as a blueprint for Black queer youth who often don't receive a relevant holistic sex education. George M. Johnson is joining us today.
First, congratulations on the release of your book, All Boys Are Not Blue. How does it feel to be getting so much love from the public? It's been so well received by many people. It's your personal testimony. How does it feel?
I guess it's like a feeling I've never had, in a sense, because I didn't know what to expect when I decided to put the book out there. And it's like, we've had queer memoirs come out, but they were centered towards adult audiences. And so to be doing this in the young adult market was definitely like a risk, because it wasn't so much as, we didn't think so much about like, were the kids not gonna respond to it, but it's like, are their parents going to be okay with me talking about my sexuality and talking about my first sexual experiences and kind of being really graphic and in detail about all of that? I will say overwhelmingly, it has been great to see support in this way. I haven't really had too much like hate mail, in a sense. Hate started to show up though once we announced the TV option. Is when it started to get like, you would see the comments. It's truly been a blessing to see, to not only see how well it's being received, but to get the messages from a lot of younger Black queer youth and teens and those who are in college who feel like they now have some type of resource guide and also feel like they can be successful, because I think a lot of them aren't sure if they could be successful and queer or if they're going to have to like hide it or, you know, do whatever. But they literally are looking to me as like an example of how you, what, you know, when you're nurtured and provided with love, what you can become. So yeah, I'm pleased, pleasantly pleased with it.
That's amazing. So you spoke a little bit about the comments and the reception and things that you were getting when it was announced that it was going to become a TV series. First of all, before we even get to the hate mail and the haters, what was your initial reaction when you found out about Gabrielle Union and just that whole process? How were you informed? How did it feel?
So interesting. I wrote an article about Gabrielle, Dwayne, and Zaya back in like right when the news first came out back. I think it was like April of last year when like the news first came out about Zaya. And I wrote this article just about when your parents who take care of queer children, like you actually can set them up for success. And they both read the article and they both reached out to me personally separately about the article and just about like my life and like what it was like growing up and being like a Black queer kid. So when the advanced reader copies became available, I just sent me and Gabrielle kind of started a relationship. So I just sent a direct message like, hey, can I send you an advanced reader copy? So we sent them out there and then it's like, you don't hear anything. And then all of a sudden you hear a lot of things. And so it was like, you know, it was like months. I was like, well, I know they have the books and, you know, maybe she has a production company. So it's like, you know, maybe her team will be interested, maybe not, I don't know. But I didn't ask like anything. I just sent the books and just kind of prayed about it. And it was like late March when we got the call that her team wanted to meet with me to discuss adapting it and what I thought an adaptation would look like and how I wanted to be involved with it. What people can expect is, I would say, like a Black queer take on a different world. So yeah, but leaning a lot more heavily into HBCU culture. So not not as focused on like a set of characters that exist throughout all 4 years, as much as how transient relationships are when you go to college and how the people you start with oftentimes aren't the people you end with.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a beauty in falling in love with a character that has to disappear, because that's how life was. Like, some people didn't come back to school, and that's a reality of HBCUs, right? Wow. Like, your favorite character may not be there because they really didn't come back to school, right? You know, but that's more real than not.
Did you ever think that writing and telling your truth would make so much space for you in the way that doors are opening up for you in ways that I'm sure as a Black queer boy growing up in America, you never imagined would happen?
You know, I didn't. And I guess I didn't because like I was like in the midst of all of this, I've actually still been figuring out my identity. And so I think it's been a really interesting journey like to get here, because you're right. For years, I've been writing my story in like bits and pieces. Around a range of topics, whether it was my identity, whether it was my family, whether it was my upbringing, whether it was sexual assault. Like, I was writing like the pieces of the things that had happened to me. And I finally just got to a point where I was like, I can't keep writing about myself in pieces, because I also don't want to keep living in pieces. So I was like, if I put the full body of work together, then I can start doing the healing work on myself to fully live in my identity. And so I think that was kind of like what helped me to make like that major decision to say like, okay, now is like the right time for you to kind of tell your full story, because it's the right time for you to live truly as who you've always wanted to be. So it's like, if I'm going to be the face of this story and the face of this, whatever you want to call it, if it's a movement, if it's breaking barriers, because this type of story isn't NYA, then I have to do the work to carry that so that I don't hurt myself in the process.
That's powerful.
That's amazing. I want to circle back to, you said when the book was released, it was received with so much love. But then when the news came out about the TV series, there was immediately, you know, this outrage of, you ain't got to put that on our kids and don't be showing that stuff. What are your thoughts on commentary like that as somebody who is in the process of healing, of taking in the things that you have experienced and written about? Here you are now reliving those stories and creating this new project, but also still working and doing the work for yourself. So when you see these comments, what happens initially and internally? And then what are your thoughts about those type of comments?
For me, the first thing that happens is like, okay, here we go again. Cause it ain't like I ain't been dragged before. It ain't like I ain't been like death threats or like I've had it all happen before. So it made like, all right, here we go again with this. For me though, part of that is like what my work is. My work is not necessarily changing the minds of those people who are naysayers, but centering people whose stories need to be told in effort to I guess find some commonality or some type of understanding amongst the fact that we aren't some monolithic community, right? Like, we are like communities with an IES. And that means that we have to tell all of the stories, right? And I think for me, I'm not as concerned when they're like, oh, we got a gay story. It's like, yeah, but that's because you think I only exist with gay people. Like, when you say, oh, he's about to tell a gay story, it's like, well, I was gay, but my best friend wasn't, and my brother isn't, and my mother isn't, and my father isn't. So am I really telling a gay story, or am I just telling the story of the fact that we exist in your world? And you can't keep denying the fact that we exist in your world, because we exist with you and we have had to create spaces to exist outside of you. But the existence of us outside of you doesn't negate the fact that we cannot run away from the fact that we have to exist with you. Y'all don't have to exist with us. Like, y'all can make a conscious choice to not exist with us and not fool with us and not deal with us. We don't have that luxury. Like, there is no way that I can only fool with or be around queer people. And so for me, part of the book writing process, the TV writing process, I always say, like, if it makes a person cringe, that's who the story is for. As much as it's for the person that needs to be seen, it's also for the person that's trying to deny my humanity. And because I've gotten messages from specifically people in the church who have read the book about how it opened their eyes to a lot of things that they have done wrong to kids, and they have done wrong to people seeking solace in the church, or people trying to find help for their sexuality in the church, then I know the message is still reaching the right people. So I'm not so worried about the comments from the people who hate it or whatever, a lot of it comes from a place of they either don't realize that they have queer people in their family or queer friends because their friends will never tell them they're queer because they hear how they talk about queer people. And so hopefully it'll kind of like bring some awakening and awareness around the fact that it's like, these are not just like gay stories, right? Like even when you watch Pose, they exist to hetero people, right? And it's like, you have a lot of hetero people who watch the show and are like, okay, I get it. Like, this is helping me get it now. Like, you know, and I hope that my show is able to do the same thing.
And to that point, George, about the larger Black community and that kind of wedge between the Black community and those who are Black and LGBTQ, what do you think the larger Black community should understand about being both Black and being both a part of that community, the LGBT community? What should they understand or about that duality, if you will?
Yeah, the biggest thing they need to understand is like, it's not one coming before the other. Like, Blackness is inclusive of queer people. And so they have to understand that, right? Like, they think like we're at war with our Blackness when it's like, no, you are at war with your Blackness because you don't fully understand that your Blackness has to encompass people that have a different identity than you. It's just, it would be almost like saying like, well, you're Black before you're a woman. It's like, well, how could that work? Like, she's a Black woman. And because she's a woman in particular, a different set of standards and a different way of life happens to her. She gets paid less. She gets treated worse. She can be killed for catcalling. That's something Black men don't have to deal with. So you can't ask her to put one in front of the other, because when she enters the room as a Black woman, a set of things will happen to her. Because that's how society is set up. That is the exact same thing that happens to a Black queer person. There's like this ask that we enter the space as Black first. And it's like, yeah, but if I'm in a room of Black people, the thing that others me is this thing. So we already all are Black here. So nobody's questioning our Blackness, because if we could all look at each other and say, okay, he Black, she Black, you Black, it's 10 of us, we all Black. Then the next thing that your brain literally starts to do is say, well, how many men in the room? Okay, well, it's 3 women, 7 dudes in the room. And then the next thing it goes to is, well, how many straight men in the room? Okay, well, 4 of us are straight, but then 3 of them is queer. And so you already do that othering. So again, but we're all still Black, right?
So I want to pivot here and ask you about another thing that a lot of us have to deal with, specifically in the Black LGBTQ plus community, which is HIV. Because in all of the things that are going on, I think over the years, people are like, oh, you pop a pill and you good, girl. Like, that doesn't even exist anymore, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's this kind of passive attitude to it. What is the work that you think still needs to be done around HIV? What are some stigmas that you believe that should be, and how can we remove them from the community?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of work still to be done around HIV. Unfortunately, you know, there was like this whole movement to like classify it as a chronic condition, and like, and I bought into it at first, but then after a while, it was like, wait a minute, like, but it's not a chronic, like, that's unrealistic, because it's like, that's not, like, you can't just change your diet and come out of that, or like, you know what I mean? Like, that's something like, it's really not a chronic condition, right? Like, there are a lot of other things you have to do in the management of HIV care and treatment. And there are barriers to care. I've been undetectable for 6 years, but I was living in New York. I just moved to New Jersey. That means my insurance has to change. That means I have to find new doctors. That means I have to find, like, all of that stuff in the midst of you trying to figure out this mangled healthcare system in America.
Right.
You easily go off treatment for months. Like, so it's just not as easy, like, as everybody thinks HIV has become, especially in the South. Like, in the South, there are still so many barriers. There just aren't. There isn't enough testing done. When you talk about stigma, I mean, you know, there's still a lot of stigma rooted in the church. There are still a lot of gays who go to church, like, religiously, and who are very, very, like, in tune with their religion. And a lot of times, that is a barrier to their sexuality. And so it gets hidden. And so they do things that are much riskier because they're hiding it, or because of their feelings that they haven't grappled with it. But then in addition to like just the church, it's like, then you got like these other stigmas where I don't think people fear death as much as they fear the shame that comes with having HIV. Mm-hmm. Because, and you know, people are like, HIV is not a death sentence. And I bought that one a couple years too. And then it was like, well, actually, a lot of people still die every year from HIV. So like, let's kind of also peel that back, because maybe not in the U.S. so much, but globally, it is still over 500,000 people, I think, a year dying from HIV. And then in the U.S., there are Black queer people I've known of that have passed away from complications with HIV who are young, but couldn't either get on treatment or weren't ready for treatment or didn't have the resources, the support around them to make them feel even comfortable going on treatment. I have an older brother who's also, because I'm HIV positive, and my older brother is also HIV positive, and he's in and out of hospitals often, and like his care doesn't look like my care. And it's two drastically different lives and lived experiences. We haven't normalized testing as much as we should have. Like, we've tried to scare people into testing, and I don't think that works. I think a better way would be to, like, as often as you get a physical, like, these are just certain tests that you should do every 6 months because of your proximity to and your risk your vulnerability for HIV because of how the virus works in these particular communities, right? And I think organizations have to do a much better job, again, meeting people where they're at and not having this assumption that everybody's just going to come in. I also think that people need to understand just because you have a college degree, just because you have a good job, does not make you immune to HIV. And I think a lot of those orgs, they target people who specifically don't have resources, and they kind of forget about the people who may have resources but not the education. And so it's like, don't leave out large swaths of people because you're making these assumptions based off of the fact that they may have went to college and they may have a government job and they may be doing well. Like, that doesn't then negate the fact that they are still vulnerable people in this community who also need protecting.
And lastly, we just want to ask you, tell our listeners why they should read your book and what do you hope for them to get out of it?
They should read my book, All Boys Aren't Blue, because unlike many other queer characters that have been written into other books, I don't die at the end. I think that is very important because one of the first things I learned when I started getting into book world was that most queer characters either get like really brutalized or they die at the end. And I was like, oh, well, that's not okay. And I'm still here, right? So like, I didn't die at the end. But seriously, I think people realistically need to read the book because there is still a lot of misinformation about just Black queer identities as a whole. There's still a lot of assumptions around like whether it's nurture versus nature, whether it's at birth versus experience. And so for me, it was important in the book to let you know, number one, this was something that was happening before I even knew what it was. So yes, kids can know that their sexuality and gender identity is in question from a very young age. Two, you need to tap into that. And you know, my book discusses like what it looks like when you have the conversations with your kid about it, or versus when your kid has to figure it out for themselves in the past that they can go down. When they don't have the language and they don't have the resources available and they end up having to use poor resources and tools to kind of make some kind of sense out of what's going on. And the third thing I think is that the book is really, really good because I give you insight into what my thoughts were. And a lot of times when you read a book, you read about the experience. And so it's like, I experienced this thing. And you could be like, oh, wow, I relate to that experience. But within when I was writing about the experiences, I also was talking about what I was thinking in my head. Because that's the part you really can't see. And you can visualize the experiences, but you can't always visualize what thoughts are going on in a child's head. And so the book gives you good insight into the fact that children have to process adult level conversations when adults aren't willing to have conversations with their children. And so I was 10 and 12 processing sexuality and gender and all of these things that I wish I had adults who knew what to say. Because that's another thing too. I loved my family and I show a lot of love in the book for my family, but they didn't have the resources. They didn't have the education, they didn't have the words. And so this book now puts a resource tool out there so that kids can have the conversations with their parents and they can have the words. And it's so funny because literally right before I got on this, someone who I used to work at Virginia Union. I went to school there, but I also used to work there. Someone who I worked with there sent me a picture of her, I believe it's her 12-year-old son, with the book and smiling with it. And so I asked, I was like, well, how does he identify? She said, well, we don't know yet, but he's trying to figure it out. And she was like, your book is probably going to help us all figure this out. And so that's realistically what this book is for. It is for those 12 and 13-year-old, and not just boys. Like, I, in my book, discussed thinking I was going to be trans because I had trans people in my family. And so it made sense. I was effeminate that was the direction to go. So it's for everyone who is at that age and at that identity crisis when they need those pieces. And for every parent that needs to figure out, how do I have these conversations? What should I be expecting? What should I be looking for? And how can we both learn this together? Because if we're reading this at the same time, it opens up the space for us to have that dialogue that we probably should be having with our kids.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, George. The book is brilliant. So proud of you. Keep up the work you're doing because you're changing lives.
So proud of you. Thank you so much for being such an amazing light in all of the darkness that's going on right now. This is the book, everybody, that you must read. It's an amazing book. Thank you so much, George, for joining us.
Thank you.
We really appreciate George coming on Dear Culture. The work he's doing is so essential. All Boys Aren't Blue is available now. Lastly, we want to end today's conversation with an artist and activist whose impact on how we talk about trans people in recent years is indelible. Of course, we're talking about Laverne Cox. She's joining Dear Culture to talk about the new documentary she's executive produced called Disclosure. The film takes a close look at the history of trans representation in film and television. Welcome, Laverne.
Hello, Garen.
Hi, Laverne. How are you?
I'm lovely. How are you?
I am fantastic. I want to first just thank you for taking time out of your schedule to talk to the Griot's Dear Culture podcast, especially because it's 4-hour Pride episode. So, your time.
Yay.
Well, first, congratulations on the release of Disclosure today. I had a chance to watch it, and it was extremely powerful and educational. Even as a member of the LGBTQ community, I can say there's so many things I was ignorant of and unaware of. And there's so much rich history that the project delves into. So could you just tell our listeners a little bit about what they can expect to see from Disclosure and why it was important for you to do?
Disclosure is a film, a documentary film that looks at the history of how transgender folks have been represented on screen, in film and on television. We tell that history through the memories of trans people. Every single person interviewed for Disclosure on camera is a transgender person, trans or non-binary person. And most of the crew behind the scenes is also trans. In the case when we couldn't find a trans person to fill a role on the crew, we had a non-trans person train a trans person. So we had this wonderful fellowship program. We had 90 applications from folks from all over the country and are cultivating the next generation of trans filmmakers. And the interesting thing, there's so many interesting things for me about Disclosure. I just rewatched it this morning now that it's available on Netflix worldwide. One of the interesting things about our film is that, and I didn't really fully understand this until I got into Sam's research, Sam Fader, our director, is that trans people have existed since the beginning of cinema. Obviously, we've existed from the beginning of time. The film tracks how folks have come to understand and then treat trans people and think about trans people and how we think about ourselves and treat ourselves as trans folks because of the images we've seen on screen. So I think in a lot of ways, we're teaching people how to react to trans folks. We're teaching people we're teaching trans folks. I remember when I saw Boys Don't Cry for the first time, I was so horrified. And it was literally a year after I started my medical transition. And I remember leaving the theater and thinking I was going to die, that like my fate as a trans person was to be brutally murdered. And we see this epidemic of the murders of trans folks, particularly trans women of color, are the most murdered trans people in our community. So correlation is not causation, but there is a relationship.
Yeah, it's pretty heartbreaking. But also, we're at a very pivotal time, as you know, with unrest in the country over racial violence and racism. I wanted to talk about the timing of Disclosure because right now we're at a very interesting pivotal point in the country. We've seen unrest for weeks over the death of Black people in this country. We've seen the Supreme Court rule in favor of LGBTQ people in terms of discrimination in the workplace. And it seems like people are, maybe their hearts and minds are a little bit more open than we've seen in other critical points of protest and civil rights. Do you think this is a moment that can create real change this time? And how can Disclosure play a role in that shift in culture?
Well, my hope is that With the Supreme Court decision that happened, that came down on Monday, which we were very shocked by, I'm still pretty shocked by it. As beautiful as that is and how exciting as that is, I was reminded that just because public policies are in place or that laws have been changed, it doesn't mean that people won't experience discrimination. It doesn't mean that people aren't going to still be murdered. Murder has been illegal, since the beginning of time. And we've had a Civil Rights Act since 1964 and a Voting Rights Act since 1965. So it's really about the people's hearts and minds being changed, right? Each and every one of us as individuals. And so the reckoning with the ways in which we've internalized transphobia, reckoning with the ways in which we've caught internalized racism, I think is really, really crucial to this moment. And I think disclosure can provide an opportunity to open minds and open hearts and change minds. And, you know, I feel like I want to say again that I don't think it's really useful to call out individual racism, because I believe that we're all racist. I believe that everyone in the United States of America has internalized the values of a white supremacist culture, a media that devalues Black bodies and stereotypes Black people in the same way. I think we've all internalized transphobia. And so the work then, if we all have indeed, we're all in this together, and we can have empathy for people who have internalized racist ideas and say, okay, how can we acknowledge this with love and then move on to the next thing? And so I think if we start from that place, we have a better shot. I spoke to Brené Brown earlier this week. She said in her work that when we deny our story, that story defines us. When we deny it, it defines us. But when we can own our story, we can write a brave new ending. And what she said about the United States of America is that we have not owned our story around our history of white supremacy in America. And so we can't move on. We can't write a brave new ending. So it is incumbent upon each of us as individuals, right, to own the story. And then as collectively individuals own the story, then we can begin to change ideology and the institutions that reinforce racism, that reinforce transphobia, sexism, class bias, et cetera. But we have to own the story. And that is the work that each of us as individuals has to do.
That's awesome. And I love Brené Brown, by the way. But my last question to you is a line in the opening of Disclosure that really stood out to me, where you said something like, I never knew in a million years that I would live in a world where trans people are celebrated. And so I want to ask you, what does it feel like today to be in that moment and to see what was once the unthinkable take form, and also you being a part of that celebration of trans people?
Immense gratitude. I was on the phone with my brother earlier. My mom's watched it, and it's just, I'm so grateful. And I think about how far I've come, you know, that as a human being, you know, from Mobile, Alabama, being raised working class with a single mother and dreaming the dream, as Oprah would put it. And then being in this place where a documentary that I executive produced is streaming all over the world, and that it centers the voices, the experiences, the stories of a diverse group of brilliant trans people. I want to cry. I just got goosebumps thinking about how brilliant we are. Just how brilliant every single person who is featured in Disclosure is, in front of and behind the camera. And I just love trans people today. I really do. I'm just so filled with joy and gratitude.
And you're doing a great job of doing it. You're inspiring not just trans people, but queer people like me too.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Oh, thank you, darling. Have a blessed day.
You too. Take care. Bye.
We want to thank Laverne for joining us, as well as DeLon and George. Amazing representation for our community, and I definitely love to see it. I want to remind our listeners to support and show love to your local Black businesses. Don't forget to donate to your local organizations and religious institutions. The business that we'll be highlighting this week is Herbal Botanicals.
Ramdasha Beekseem and Shabina Torora are the entrepreneurs behind Herbal Botanicals, a CBD healing salve that can be used for pain relief, decreasing inflammation and swelling, massage, or aromatherapy. Composed of simple local ingredients, CBD, sun ground flowers, arnica, lavender, shea butter, and olive oil.
This product sounds amazing, and I know a lot of us can use some CBD right now. TheGrill.com has published a list of 50-plus Black businesses to support during the coronavirus pandemic. If you'd like your business to be featured, email us at info@TheGrill.com. That's G-R-I-O.
Thank you for listening to Dear Culture. If you like what you heard, please give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast and share it with everyone you know.
Please email all questions, suggestions, and compliments to podcast@TheGrill.com. The Dear Culture podcast is brought to you by The Grill and executive produced by Natasha F. Alford, Rob Dozier, and Kevin Y. Brown.